Okay, I'm going to start. And in today's lecture, I want to introduce you to a specific constellation of literary critical issues via the work of the critic Gayatri Spivak and the writer Mahashweta Devi. But these are also critical issues that are important to our continuing consideration of the Buddha of suburbia. Okay. So we haven't left the Buddha behind by any stretch of the imagination. In particular, today's critical questions have to do with what one might call the question or the problem of representation. Okay, so that's going to be the thrust of today's lecture. In Spivak's work, the question of representation is always double-edged. In one sense, it refers to represent, as in the work of imagination that represents reality in literature and in art, but also to represent, as in to stand for, to stand in for, to speak as in the realm of politics, for instance. So there's a double meaning of representation that Spivak works on in all her writing. But before I really go into some of her theoretical work and her contributions, perhaps a few words about Gayatri Spivak herself to put things in some context. Spivak was born in India and graduated from Calcutta University and went on to receive a PhD in comparative literature from Cornell University in the US. She has been part of the American academic scene since the early 1960s, and she's currently a professor at Columbia University in New York, becoming a star on the academic conference and lecture circuits in the 1980s, which were a decade of proliferating identity politics on US campuses. The 1980s was the decade in which African American, Asian American, Latino-Latina studies, gay and lesbian studies, gender studies departments were established and consolidated. Spivak famously translated the French philosopher Jacques Derrida's book of Grammatology when she was in her 20s and introduced the Anglo-American Academy to Derrida's work. Spivak's own positioning as an Indian intellectual in the Western Academy, one who was fully at home and, in fact, who had mastered its dominant codes, made her a much desired public figure, even as many criticized her for exploiting her position and encouraging the cult of her personality, for indulging in self-exoticization. For people like me who went through graduate school in the 1990s, you know, she was a much talked about figure as somebody, you know, who was very much into performance and into presenting her own identity as part of her theoretical work. She would famously appear at lectures and conferences wearing, you know, resplendent silk saris with leather boots and her hair cropped short and dyed red. So she made, you know, quite a spectacle. For a decade in which identity was being hailed as deeply political and as a performance, Spivak was definitely a star. But on a more serious note, Spivak has been a key and quite controversial figure within post-colonial literary studies and theory, right? That aspect of literary studies that looks at literature from the middle of the 20th century and later, literature written in the ex-colonized countries, in the ex-colonial countries of Africa and Asia. Her extremely abstract, high theoretical language and style that expresses a virtuosic familiarity with high European theory, as well as classical Indian texts in Sanskrit and Bengali. So in the same sentence, she'll be quoting Kant and Hegel, but also some obscure Sanskrit text, is seen to be at odds with her Marxist feminism and her purported project of speaking for the subaltern, the underprivileged, the marginalized. So I wanted to draw your attention that if you find her writing difficult, you're not alone, right? Many other critics find her writing very, very difficult and complex. It is perhaps fitting then, although curious nevertheless, that the anthology assigned for this module has two interviews with Spivak rather than her essays. The genre of the interview, I think, is interesting because it allows her to stage herself as an intellectual, even though she seems surprisingly unself-conscious of that happening in many places, and in other places seems to relish it. Okay, I will now address some of the key critical themes in the interviews that the interviews touch upon and that we might find useful as modes of reading. And then towards, in the second half of this lecture, I will also talk about an essay of hers that I think is quite influential and informs many of the things she says in the interviews, her essay, Can the Subaltern Speak? Okay, so the first theme that I think the interviews touch upon and that are of interest to us is the theme of authenticity and identity. Okay, in many ways, as you know, this is also a key critical problem in Qureshi's novel. As Spivak points out, any one of us inhabits many subject positions, but dominant culture ends up treating people as representatives and tokens of our subject positions. And there's a desire to read characters in Qureshi's novel, characters such as Karim's father, as representing Indian culture, right? Another example is the struggle of Karim to be simultaneously Indian and English, an actor, someone with a still undefined sexuality. So while he's all of those things, he's Indian, he's English, he's an actor whose sexuality is somewhat ambiguous, there is another sort of force that the novel addresses, which is the force to fix Karim's identity as a representative of a particular community. So while the racist or fascist wants to obliterate all traces of difference of the other, even as they need the other to maintain their own identity, the liberal desire to hear, to listen to the other, typically leads to a demand for authentic voices, right? So in the novel, there is a search on the part of so many characters for authenticity, right? What is authentic about a particular identity? This is both the political challenge and the pitfall of multiculturalism, I think, in which certain people are made to speak for all immigrants. Okay, and that's one of the issues that Spivak is addressing in the interviews. Who gets to speak, who gets to represent their community, right? Their race, their gender, etc. In particular, gender in immigrant communities gets elided as male representatives represent the community. And that is Jamila's struggle, as I mentioned last week. Or 2 weeks ago. And minority communities are stereotypically assumed to be traditional and religious and conservative, right? You see that in the dominant discourse of multiculturalism in Britain today, right? Where to be a minority, there's an assumption that you must be religious or must be traditional or community bound. And there is sort of very little space increasingly for secular and progressive voices, right? And this again connects back with Jamila's struggle. Post 9/11 and 7/11 in particular, the British government's advisors on Islam, as if it is one thing, one culture, have been conservative Muslim men. They are the experts, right? And this is, as I've been saying, the predicament of Jamila in the novel. Diasporic culture then is also complicit in gender exploitation, right? As minority men take the position of representing the entire community, right? Often silencing women's voices. There is a nostalgic longing in diasporic literature and culture towards customs, cooking, religion, and tradition. Hanif Qureshi, in his book, My Son, the Fanatic, represents this very powerfully, in which the deadly cocktail of racism and multiculturalism, a deadly mix of destruction, produces religious fundamentalism and authoritarianism in the younger generation of immigrants who are caught between, you know, the racists who want to efface them, you know, from public culture in Britain, and their own communities who want to stick to tradition and to conservatism. This aspect of multiculturalism that constructs the authentic migrant has an older colonial history in the figure of the native informant, the figure who mediates between native cultures and British culture, the one who translates native culture for consumption and knowledge production in the West. And I'll be talking more about it next week when we discuss Edward Said. Nevertheless, we can already note that knowledge about the East is thus deeply tainted because of colonialism. Another pitfall of liberal multiculturalism is the aspect of tokenism, which leads to ghettoization. And again, this is something taken up by Qureshi in his novel. As Spivak points out, this is also a kind of silencing, right? When we make the minority or the immigrant a token of his or her culture. We can see this at play in the field of English literary studies, in which Black and Asian writers are introduced in standard curricula to represent whole cultures and national traditions. Thus, when Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children was published, he was supposed to have given voice to a whole subcontinent. Okay? So what I'm suggesting is that a large thrust of Spivak's interview is on this question of who does she represent, right? And the complexity and the problem of when you are speaking as a minority scholar, right? As a scholar from a minority community, the assumption is that you're speaking for a whole culture, for a whole community. And that's also a predicament that writers like Hanif Qureshi have often expressed, right? The problem of labeling, of tokenization, whereby Hanif Qureshi is always a Black British writer and not just seen as a British writer. So these, all of these issues have, you know, become big problems for Spivak, and she addresses that in her scholarship. Another sort of big space of contention in Spivak's work is, of course, the classroom itself. Okay, in all her writing and her pedagogical practices, Spivak turns the classroom and the dynamics within the space of a classroom into the stuff of her theory and her politics. Okay, so I want to turn your attention, if you have the book, to page 597. And otherwise, if you can just listen as I read this long paragraph, where this is from the top of page 597. You can refer to it later. Just mark the page. Where she says, I will have in an undergraduate class, let's say, a young white male student, politically correct, who will say, I'm only a bourgeois white male. I can't speak. In that situation, it's peculiar because I'm in the position of power and their teacher, and on the other hand, I'm not a bourgeois white male. I say to them, why not develop a certain degree of rage against the history that has written such an abject script for you that you are silenced? Okay, so she's asking the white male who feels silenced while reading, you know, works by subaltern writers, by marginalized writers from the third world. Right? What place do I have when I'm reading this? What can I say? And she says, why don't you turn that space where you cannot speak, right, into something to think about, into rage? Right? Why have you been put in that position? Then you begin to investigate what it is that silences you rather than take this very deterministic position. Since my skin color is this, since my sex is this, I cannot speak. I call these things, as you know, somewhat derisively, chromatism, basing everything on skin color. I'm white, I can't speak. And genitalism, depending on what kind of genitals you have, you can or cannot speak in certain situations. From this position, then, I say, you will, of course, not speak in the same way about the third world material, but if you make programs of study, but if you make it your task not only to learn what is going on there through language, through specific programs of study, but also at the same time through a historical critique of your position as the investigating person, then you will see that you have earned the right to criticize and you be heard. So this is a call to not read anything that you are reading, you know, in modes of reading or in other modules, to read it passively, right? But to investigate your own position. She's calling for each student to investigate his or her own position and their relationship to the text that they are reading. When you take the position of not doing your homework, I will not criticize because of my accident of birth, the historical accident, that is a much more pernicious position. In one way, you take a risk to criticize, of criticizing something which is other, something which you used to dominate. I say that you have to take a certain risk. To say, I won't criticize, is salving your conscience and allowing you not to do any homework. On the other hand, if you criticize, having earned the right to do so, then you are indeed taking a risk and you will probably be made welcome and can hope to be judged with respect. You can just imagine being that white male student in Spivak's classroom, right, where she calls upon you and says, you know, this is who you are, you know, history has constructed this script for you, and which is why you feel that when you read a powerful story like Devi's Draupadi, right, you are stunned into silence, there's nothing you can say, but she says, you must say, you must speak. And I think that there is a kind of relationship there also to the whole question of multiculturalism, right, where any atrocity being committed by minority communities, you know, where liberal intellectuals often feel silenced, right? How can we speak about the other? And in Spivak's work, she points out how this is specifically detrimental to gender issues, right? Because women are caught between their community, right, and the larger culture. So what Spivak is really asking for is a historical critique of your position as a reader, as a student, as an investigating person, right? And she says it is pernicious to take a totally relativist position, that, you know, their culture is about unfreedom, ours is about freedom and rights, but the idea of humanity, of rights, of freedom, Spivak insists, are universal, right? There's nothing sort of culturally specific about these. These are valued in all cultures. And it is the legacy of colonialism that has rendered them as Western, right? So you'll often hear in political discourse of leaders of European countries or the United States that, you know, they're exporting democracy, right? Or bringing rights for women in Afghanistan. Spivak's argument would be that these are universal ideals, right? But that colonialism has made it such that they are represented as being Western in origins. These issues are particularly relevant and central to Spivak's theorization of the gendered subaltern. Okay, and I'll now talk about her essay, Can the Subaltern Speak?, which has not been assigned to you, and it's a really, really dense essay. I still struggle with it. But I think that some of the ideas that she presents there are worth thinking about, and are particularly useful in terms of reading the short story, okay, assigned for this week. The essay, Can the Subaltern Speak? The essay title is a question, okay? Can the Subaltern Speak? Is about, precisely about the politics of representation, okay? And Spivak writes this essay as part of a collective of historians from India who called themselves the Subaltern Studies Group of Historians, which was a collective of left-leaning historians of India who formed a group in the late 1970s and who produced a radical rethinking of historical representation and of the relationship between historical and literary representation. Okay? From the Marxist Italian theorist Antonio Gramsci, the subaltern studies historians took the term subaltern, referring to masses or the common people. Okay? That's sort of the meaning. Gramsci had used the term to refer to those classes in society that were left out of the historic transformation of the Italian state in the 1870s. So all the non-elite sections of society, right, who had no role in the formation of civil society and the state, etc., Gramsci referred to those non-elite groups of people as subalterns. Subalterns are therefore not a proper class as such, but are marked by heterogeneity, right? So tribals, peasants, working classes, the poor, the slum dwellers, poor women, all of these different groups, you know, could be thought of as subalterns, all groups who have not had access to civil society, to state power, etc. Okay? In this essay, Spivak talks about how colonial politics, and here she's talking about the condition in India, right, which was ruled by the British for 200 years, from 1857 to 1947, that colonial politics split society into two domains. There was the domain of the elite, privileged by the dominant discourse to deal with the rulers on behalf of all colonized. Right? So under colonialism, there emerged a class of people, right, who became representatives. Again, the whole idea of representation, who spoke on behalf of all natives to the colonial state. The presence of the subaltern domain of the non-elite was left out, right, through oversight, but also through design, and was inaccessible to the political sphere, right, to the elite sphere. Similarly, even after independence, Spivak argues that this domain of the subalterns, right, of the weak, the marginalized, the poor, the dispossessed, has continued to be ignored, right? And this, I think, could be applied to so many different national situations. And that it represents the failure of the Indian bourgeoisie to speak for the nation. Okay, the fact that elites generally ignore the subalterns and represent their own class interests, right, means that they are not really representative. And I mean, I think that these are sort of questions that could be asked of in this country as well, right? Who do the members of parliament really represent? Do they represent the entire nation, those who suffer the most, or do they tend to represent their own particular class constituencies? The central thesis of Spivak's essay is that the actuality of the lives and forms of consciousness of the disenfranchised masses of colonial and post-colonial society, whether peasantry or the urban working class, cannot find adequate representation in elite modes of conceptualization and of writing, of textualization. And I'll repeat this. This is the central and the key argument, right? That the subalterns, she argues, the dispossessed, the marginalized, cannot find adequate representation in elite modes of writing and of conceptualization. So she's making an argument that middle-class writers, bourgeois writers, middle-class literary critics can never adequately represent, right, the subaltern. Okay. Therefore, you see that Spivak is constructing the subaltern as a kind of subject position about powerlessness, right? And she would include tribals, subsistence farmers, unorganized peasant labor, etc., right? So that it's a kind of class position, but also a subject position, right? The inability to speak, the inability to represent, the inability to be represented. And she says that when elite, whether it's politicians or writers, do attempt to represent the subaltern, what they engage in is a kind of epistemic violence. This is an important term from Spivak, epistemic violence, okay? That they construct the subaltern as an absolute other, right? As a figure which is exotic, you know, which cannot be reached. And in doing so, you know, when they do construct the subaltern, they engage in a kind of a violence that is epistemic, right? That's about meaning and about life itself, okay? So in this whole problematic of the inability of elite writers, of elite literature to represent the subaltern, Spivak comes back to this issue of the need to question the position of the investigator, the writer, the theorist, okay? And she says in that essay that first world intellectuals often valorize the concrete experience of the oppressed, but remain uncritical about their own positions as intellectuals. So this constant sort of self-reflection, right? Whether you're students, theorists, writers, intellectuals, right? How are you approaching a particular material, especially material which is difficult, such as the story that you've read for today and that I will be talking about, okay? Another key question that Spivak problematizes in this essay, but also in her work, is the idea of where do we get our knowledge from about the other, right? And she talks about the relationship between knowledge and power. And this is something that we will take up again when we discuss Said, okay? That in order to really get at the representation of the subaltern, we have to, in a way, dismantle how we've thought of history, right? Dismantle the archive and look at the question of silence. And I think this connects back to her, the title of the essay, Can the Subaltern Speak? To ask ourselves, to think about not only what a text says, right? But to think about what a text does not say, okay? And what a text cannot say. So for instance, if you look at colonial records, right, there's often an absence of a discussion on peasant insurgency, right? Because those are official records that create official history. So in her consideration of historical knowledge and official archive, right, which holds knowledge and information from an elite perspective, how can we look at history and discover the history of subalterns when the subalterns are nothing but an absence in these records? Okay. So in conclusion on this, for Spivak, subaltern history itself is a necessary impossibility. It's a theoretical fiction, okay? That we cannot ever fully construct subaltern history because the archive itself, the materials that we have for constructing the history of peasants and tribals, right, that material itself is closed off to the experience of tribals and peasants, right? Because the history that is valorized, that is canonized, is the history written by elites, right, for elites. So that's a central thrust. Nevertheless, and this is one of the sort of key dilemmas at the heart of Spivak's work, we have to continue to think of this problem, right? In spite of this impossibility, we have to continue to think of how can we represent the subaltern and how can we write subaltern history. For Spivak, the work of criticism must be to problematize this, that we have to constantly grapple with this, and to theorize subaltern consciousness in terms of agency, action, and historical consciousness. Right? How can we construct the subaltern as a subject of history? The difficulty of this is that, you know, for a lot of people, this seems like hitting your head against a wall, right? She's telling you that you cannot really adequately represent the subaltern, particularly the subaltern woman, right? You cannot really adequately write their history because historical records leave out subalterns. And yet the work of criticism must be to constantly address this question, right? And to problematize this question. And that in itself is what is meaningful and important for Spivak, right? To always keep this question in the foreground. Okay? In particular, the figure of this gendered subaltern, the subaltern woman, okay, that is of particular interest to Spivak. And she points to how sort of very recent fields of study, such as development studies, women's studies, multicultural studies, have produced so much writing on the subaltern woman, right? And yet Spivak argues that the subaltern woman remains mute as ever, right? That even those social theorists and social scientists and feminist literary critics who try to represent the subaltern woman, they do not really adequately question the whole problem of representation. Okay? For Spivak, then, what does this mean? She is looking at the question of speaking to as opposed to speaking for. So what Spivak is arguing is that we need to speak to the subaltern woman, not speak for the subaltern woman. Okay? And secondly, and this is, I think, what was also the thrust of the passage I read out where she's addressing a white male student in her class, the unlearning of privilege, right? And through the investigation of our own positions, right? To be aware of our own privileges as middle-class students, you know, at Warwick University. What are the privileges we assume that we never think about, right? Do we read a text like Mahashweta Devi's story as an oddity, as an exotic piece of writing, as something that is so different and so other from our experience that, you know, we have trouble getting at what it means, right? How do we relate to a story like this? This would be a very important theoretical and political question for Spivak. Of course, other critics have criticized Spivak for this essay and for other work and have argued that subaltern women do speak and they have spoken. Spivak would agree with that. She would just say that we don't know how to listen to the subaltern woman. And that this absolute difference that we often construct, right, with our, between ourselves as privileged students, teachers, intellectuals, and this poor tribal woman whose story we read, right? I mean, we are just worlds apart, right? But what Spivak would argue that if we insist on historicizing this gap, right, between ourselves and the story that we read about, right, that is the work of criticism, right? That should be the work of critical theory, to historicize this gap, to problematize. Why does this story that is so different appeal to us? Before I go on to talk about the story, I want us to see a brief clip of an interview with Mahashweta Devi, who is a writer, an activist, a journalist, who in many ways is the sort of quintessential organic intellectual. She has lived and she lives and works among the tribal groups that she writes about, both in her journalism and in her fiction. And she writes in Bengali. She writes in sort of vernacular newspapers and magazines about tribal issues, etc. And Spivak has had a long-term project of translating Mahashweta Devi's stories from the Bengali into English. And in fact, has, one could say, has played a key role in introducing Mahashweta Devi's work to the Anglo-American Academy. So let's sort of watch this brief clip. It'll give you a sense of Mahashweta Devi's context and ...10% of India's population, but they are among the most marginalized of citizens of India. And with the short story of Devi's, Draupadi, we turn to what could be called protest fiction, because the story is written in the context of what Devi says in this documentary. Devi has been involved in narrating the stories of these tribals who are, along with untouchables, that's another category of people who make a big section of subalterns. She has been writing and representing them, right? This particular story, which I'll tell you what it's drawn from, has to be read in the context of a militant Maoist movement called the Naxalite movement, which has been taking place in India from the late 1960s onwards. And in fact, there has been a big resurgence of this militant movement in which tribals are playing a big part. As some of you may know, from the 1990s onwards, India opened up its previously socialist economy to global finance capital, right? And so one of the effects of that has been that there are these big multinational pharmaceutical and other industries wanting to set themselves up in India, right? And the land which they often want, because tribals have historically lived in forests, they want tribal lands because they're rich in forests, in minerals, etc. So what we are seeing in India now is this massive scale of displacement of tribal people. As Mahashweta Devi says, they're left not even with a handful of dust, right? And in response to that, many people think that this militant Maoist movement called the Naxalite movement has been gaining ground, right, which is working against the state, right, that is involved in dispossessing tribals on behalf of global capital. Okay, in this particular documentary, Devi talked about the Santhal rebellion, which was a rebellion under colonial rule, right, in which tribals were being exploited by moneylenders and by merchants and, you know, were constantly caught up in a never-ending cycle of debt. You can see in many ways contemporary militant movements in which tribals are taking part as part of that older rebellion. So in a sense that their struggle, far from ending after independence, has in fact been reinforced. And many people see this as a failure of Indian democracy, the failure of the state's representation of all Indians. This particular story then brings up the issue of resistance quite centrally, because Dobdi is, you can figure out from the story, is a militant, right? She's a militant on the run. She and her husband have been involved in fighting the police and in fighting the state officers, and they've been accused of killing a policeman, right? And her husband has died, but the police are aware that she's still alive, she's on the run, and they are after her. And they think that they can find her because she will come looking for her husband's body. What is really interesting and important about the story is that it is also an imaginative rendering of a story from the Mahabharata, which is one of the two great Hindu epics that Mahashweta Devi also talked about in this documentary. And I'll just sort of quickly tell you what Draupadi's story from the Mahabharata is. In that story, there are two kingdoms at war, and the rulers of both the kingdoms are actually related by blood to each other. They are cousins, and they are at war. The more righteous kingdom is led by these five brothers, the Pandavas, who are all married to Draupadi. And the war starts when these five brothers are called upon by the other kingdom that wants to wage a war with them to play a game of dice. And they say and the argument is that whoever loses this game will have to lose their kingdom and will have to give it up to the other side. So the five brothers who are married to Draupadi undertake to play this game of dice. And they start losing because the other side, you know, cheats. And it is fated that the more righteous, the five brothers, the Pandavas, are going to lose this game of dice. So they slowly start losing everything that they have including losing their kingdom, when they have nothing more left to lose, the sort of the evil side says, well, you still have something else that you can give up because you're losing this game of dice. And they said, well, you have your wife, Draupadi. You need to give her up because you've lost this game. And the brothers, her husbands, give her up, and she's brought on into the center of the court. And the evil cousins who won the game and supposedly won the war, they start disrobing her in public. In order to shame her. And here again, you sort of see how gender, you know, plays a role, right? That shaming of the woman is sort of the ultimate humiliation that can be brought upon. Now, Draupadi, as it turns out in the story, is a huge devotee of Lord Krishna, okay? And as the evil brothers start unveiling her and start pulling her sari to disrobe her and to shame her, she starts praying to Lord Krishna. And as she starts praying, her sari keeps getting extended miraculously, right? So the more the brothers pull her sari, the longer it grows. And of course, they're unable to disrobe her. They are unable to shame her. This is the story of Draupadi in the Mahabharata. As you can see, Mahashweta Devi is imaginatively rendering this story in the current context, in which Draupadi's abjected body, right, the raped, the tortured body, transforms into a resistant body at the end of the story. The body itself speaks, because as you know in the story, Draupadi is finally captured, right, and Draupadi is the tribal variation of the more Sanskritic name Draupadi. Draupadi is captured, and she's taken into a corner, and all night she's raped, right? She's raped by the police constables and the police officers. And the next morning, as the story tells us, the chief police guy comes and he says, you know, he wants to be shown the trophy that Draupadi is, that she has been captured. And he asks for her to be presented to him, to be shown to him, right? In sort of her full shame of having been part of this anti-state, anti-militant movement. So Draupadi is brought out, right? Her body is covered with bruises and marks. She has been gang raped all night, right? Her pubic hair is matted with blood. There's blood all over her body. The story forces you to imagine that scene. And as she's brought out, instead of being shamed, instead of crouching, right, Draupadi stands there erect, straight, looking the police chief in his eye, okay? And what Devi shows is this very, very powerful reversal of shame there, right? Because it is there that the police officer who gets shamed, right, rather than Draupadi. He says to a junior police officer, you know, get her away. Ask her to hide, you know, her private parts, right? Because he really cannot face her. And there's this very, very powerful reversal of shame there, because it is not Draupadi who's shamed, right? Even though she's naked and she's defenseless, right? It's the state, it's the police constable who is shamed because his own atrocity, his own brutality, right, is standing there face to face in front of him. So you can sort of see the interesting parallel there between the Mahabharata story, right, and the story of this gendered subaltern woman, Draupadi, that Mahashweta Devi writes about. It's a very, very moving and very, very powerful story, and I think that there's lots there to think about. But I think in very useful ways, it makes Spivak's theories, right, of representation, because I think the one big question we must all have is that, does Devi succeed in representing the subaltern? And I think that in standing there alone, you know, she's in a way a very lonely figure there. It's Draupadi who does, she represents herself. Then there's nobody to mediate on her behalf, right? In fact, she refuses mediation, right? And she represents herself. And even though she does not speak, right, you can see that in the story, Devi is suggesting that her wounds, the blood on her body, the gaping wound in her body, that speaks. And I think that that sort of, again, complicates the whole issue of what do we mean when we talk about, you know, the subaltern speaking, right? Who is doing the speaking, where, in what context, and how are we listening? How are we reading? And I've always found that even though, as I said, the context of this story is so alien, you know, it's also very moving and powerful and easy to relate to. I've always found that people are shaken up by this story. So there's something about that gap that Spivak theorizes in her work, right? That does work. That does work if you theorize it and if you historicize it. Okay? So I'll end here, and next week we'll talk about Saeed. Thank you.